Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. Taking Manhattan, The Extraordinary Events That Created New York and Shaped America, by Russell Shorto. The book cover has a watercolor picture of New Amsterdam, or Manhattan, from the 17th century, with a masted ship and a small sailboat in the river approaching the harbor. The reviewer is Jacob Goldstein. 320 years before the Muppets, the English took Manhattan. In Taking Manhattan, Russell Shorto pays close attention to the darker aspects of colonial life on the island at the center of the world. There is a map of the 17th century Lower Manhattan, at the time called New Amsterdam, created by the Dutch West India Company. The caption reads, "A map made in the 19th century depicting Lower Manhattan in the 17th century." The British are coming. Specifically, Colonel Richard Nichols, fought in France, jailed by Cromwell, partied with the Duke of York, is sailing in to take New Amsterdam from the Dutch. Rushing around the southern tip of Manhattan, scrambling to save his village, is Peter Stuyvesant, a Dutch West India Company man whose employment history includes getting a leg sawed off after a Caribbean battle and heading north to run the trading post at the mouth of the Hudson. You know who is going to wind up with the island in 1664. We're not sitting around eating stroopwafels here. But in Taking Manhattan, Russell Short tells the story beautifully and makes a compelling case for its enduring importance. There were two takings, really, and they came one right after the other. The Dutch took Manhattan from the indigenous Lenape in 1626. Then the British took it from the Dutch 38 years later. The second taking is the heart of this book. The British, rebounding from decades of infighting, the beheading of Charles I, Cromwell's rule, the Restoration, wanted to extend their North American land grab. The Dutch had claimed territory from present-day Albany to Delaware, and the center of the action, then as now, was Manhattan. The Dutch West India Company had set up shop on the island to ship beaver pelts across the Atlantic, and the village that sprang up was, in Shorto's telling, fundamentally Dutch, wildly capitalistic, and also, in a circumscribed relative way, unusually tolerant for its time. In an age of monarchies, the Dutch had formed a new republic in Europe. The agreement that unified the country in 1579 had specified that no one shall be investigated or persecuted because of his religion, a radical position that other countries thought was a terrible idea. This freedom extended to New Amsterdam, and it drew hustlers from all over Europe, immigrants who transformed the colony from a regional office of the West India Company into a cosmopolitan village that seeded the modern metropolis. As Shorto puts it, New York was New York even before it was New York. This was, more or less, the argument Shorto made 21 years ago in The Island at the Center of the World, his book about Dutch Manhattan that became a minor classic among popular New York histories and a perennial player in stoop giveaway piles. The new book is more a reboot than sequel. It covers similar literal and figurative ground. But in Taking Manhattan, Shorto draws on recent scholarship to describe the lives of ordinary people, largely left out of the earlier book, reminding us that a city built on commerce led to freedom for some and horrifying exploitation of others. Dorothea Angola, Shorto tells us, arrived in New Amsterdam enslaved, possibly in 1627. She married and had children, and in 1644, her husband petitioned the Dutch West India Company for the couple's freedom, which was granted. Soon after, they were given a 6-acre tract to farm in what would become Greenwich Village. But their children were not freed. There's no evidence that they were pressed into forced labor, but Shorto writes that this unbelievably cruel caveat would certainly have ensured that the parents would do whatever the company asked of them. Later, Angola petitioned for and was granted freedom for their adopted son. The story of native people is full of death and dispossession, but the 17th century power dynamics were complex. At one key moment, Shorto writes, a Montucket leader named Quasham, facing encroaching British settlers on Long Island, wanted to ally with the Dutch. It seems she tried to warn Stuyvesant that British ships were coming to take Manhattan, but he ignored the message. Quasham wound up joining forces with the British and the Shinnecock instead. This is why, when Nichols and the British sailed in, it was a surprise to the Dutch. Nichols gave Stuyvesant 2 days to surrender or be attacked. Meanwhile, the Dutch fought among themselves. The British sent Stuyvesant a note, and he tore it up before the city council could read it. But at the moment of peak danger, Shorto argues, Stuyvesant redeemed himself. He recognized a duty not just to his bosses at the West India Company, but to this new weird city that was becoming its own thing. An hour before Nichols' ultimatum expired, Stuyvesant wrote back. He was willing to negotiate to save the city. Nichols wanted New Amsterdam not just for its strategic location, but for its open commercial culture. So, Shorto writes, he agreed to a deal that reads more like a corporate merger than a treaty of surrender. The deal guaranteed that Dutch people could continue to come to New Amsterdam and enjoy freedom of religion. Dutch ships could still come and go freely, and the local government could continue to function largely as before. Nichols changed the name to New York because he liked it better that way. It honored his buddy, the Duke of York, who would eventually become King James II. The name was new, but the city, on the make, polyglot, racist in some ways, and tolerant in others, would endure. It is hard to love the city and to recognize its horrors, but it is possible. There is proof. Russell Shorto has done it. The reviewer, Jacob Goldstein, is the host of What's Your Problem, a podcast about business and technology, and the author of Money, the True Story of a Made-Up Thing. The Passenger Seat by Vijay Khurana. The book cover is a photo of a view from inside a car looking out into the blurred car headlights and taillights at night. The reviewer is Teddy Wayne. A turbulent road trip to manhood, loaded gun in tow. Two teenage boys set out north with few plans and plenty of frustration in Vijay Khurana's novel, The Passenger Seat. The Passenger Seat, Vijay Khurana's unsettling and powerful debut novel, follows two teenagers on the fragile cusp of manhood in a Canadian border town. Adam lives with his failure of a father, a former boat builder now delivering pizza, and hasn't seen his mother in 6 years. Teddy's well-off family is ostensibly functional, but atomized, his mother barely concealing her affair, his father in blithe denial. Teddy is handsome, socially accepted, and has a girlfriend he's not particularly close with, a source of envy for Adam, who repels the opposite sex with his coarse appearance and coarser manners. Thus, the classic Ferrantian dyad of the volatile working-class friend and the more privileged introspective observer with whom the reader, and invariably the introspective observant author, identifies. But whereas Ferrante and other writers confine us to the point of view of the softer character, Khurana's precise, subtle narration roves freely between both boys, and Adam's interior life is as rich as Teddy's. The boys take a summer road trip north with no destination in mind, though Adam, the only one who can drive his truck, dreams of reinventing himself in the Arctic. Teddy, while ignominiously stuck in the titular passenger seat, does have a gun license, and he purchases a Chekhovian hunting rifle in the first act. After a moment of reckless escalation, the two go on the lam. If the inciting episode reads as an overdetermined proof of male one-upmanship, Khurana's execution of it is nevertheless gripping. Things go pear-shaped. Then the pear goes rotten as the boys harbor resentments, thwart each other, and secretively plot. Readers hoping for a rollicking backseat hang with Saul Paradise and Dean Moriarty will be disappointed. The author courageously doesn't try to make his protagonists enjoyable company. Their banter is seldom playful, and the spare dialogue is delivered without quotation marks, rendering the numberless chapters and long paragraphs even more hushed. Neither suffers from any discrete trauma, aside from their unhappy families that might curry sympathy. Nor does Khurana lard the novel with every hot-button cultural totem of toxic masculinity. Only a first-person shooter video game called Patriot and a Jordan Peterson-style book that the right-wing tilting Adam has adopted as his Bible make fleeting appearances. To avoid being tracked, the boys turn off their phones, mercifully limiting engagement with the manosphere. The story is most relevant in the context of 2025, but could just as easily have taken place in 1965. Khurana's more timeless interest lies in homosocial competition. From an early age, he has been taught that to have something, a toy, a trophy, counts double if your friend has none. The juvenile name-calling and micro-assertions of dominance, the jockeying for the driver's seat that suits neither character especially well. Both are lost boys, dependent on the other for companionship, perplexed by the contradictions the world asks them to negotiate. What a simple masculinity that would be, Adam thinks in one of the passages whose free and direct discourse feels too elevated for the minds of teenage boys, to be free of guilt and reason, to focus on nothing more than the creation of more bison. The passenger seat admirably resists a lurid climax befitting Patriot, instead offering an extended coda about a minor character alluded to early on. The portrait of a financially successful but lonely middle-aged bachelor is nearly as tragic in its own way as that of Teddy and Adam. If this is what manhood had in store for them, we can understand why they wanted out. The reviewer, Teddy Wayne, is the author, most recently, of The Winner. His next novel, The Au Pair, will be published in 2026. See Friendship by Jeremy Gordon. The book cover is yellow and has two flip phones side by side. One is flipped open and shows a text of a review saying, "A Literal Triumph" by Brian Washington. The other flip phone is closed, with a small text screen saying, "A novel." The reviewer is Ryan Chapman. His pitch to save his career, a podcast about his dead best friend. In Jeremy Gordon's novel, See Friendship, a journalist reinvestigates his past, only to discover the story he was told about his friend's death wasn't true. In the decade since the hit show Serial turned the name Adnan into a dinner party mononym, a new protagonist archetype has emerged, the podcaster. Often these narrators play amateur detectives pursuing true crime cases involving violence against young women. I Have Some Questions for You by Rebecca Mackay and Sadie by Courtney Summers. Other times, the narrator is pulled into manosphere buffoonery, friend of the pod, Sam Limpsite. Now we have Jeremy Gordon's debut novel, See Friendship, whose reluctant podcaster is adrift and full of anxiety. The novel is at heart a millennial's take on grief-inflected nostalgia. It follows Jacob Goldberg, a 31-year-old Jewish-Chinese journalist working at a moderately respected culture website. He spent a decade churning out essays on exhibitions at the Whitney and pop icon surprise albums. For his next venture for the publication, Jacob pitches a podcast series about a close high school friend, Seth, who died unexpectedly the year after Jacob graduated. Seth was the Jay Catsby to Jacob's Nick Carraway. There wasn't a single person at our high school he didn't get along with, and he could expand this invitational aura to include anyone. Jacob recalls. Seth was also black Brazilian and gay. He and Jacob bonded as two biracial students at the predominantly white Gale Sayers Prep, just outside Chicago, one of the most segregated cities in the United States. As much as Jacob loves Seth, the podcast is not a passion project. Jacob sees job security in pivoting to the ad-friendly audio format, and though he knows that One Dead Friend is a tough anchor to sustain an entire series, he figures he can pad out the episodes with 9/11, the George W. Bush administration, and other aughts-era signifiers. Despite his boss's ambivalent response, Jacob proceeds apace, collecting the details he thinks he'll need to produce a show. We might pause here. Reading about someone else's podcast research is on par with a friend sharing last night's dream. If we're not in it, don't bother. But see, friendship holds our interest by sending Jacob on a spree of interviews with his former classmates in Chicago and Los Angeles that revises his memories of his late friend's final months. He documents romantic fumblings over ambitious theater productions and a skirmish at Seth's funeral. He also hooks us with a plot twist. It turns out Seth didn't die from a vague stomach condition, as Jacob believed, but from a heroin overdose. And a much-despised local musician named Lee Finch is somehow responsible. Jacob decides confronting Lee will provide a satisfying climax for the podcast and long-awaited closure for himself. It would all make for a tidy story for both podcast and novel, but Gordon, who is an editor at The Atlantic with bylines at Pitchfork, GQ, and the New York Times Magazine, rejects tidiness. Jacob isn't a terribly good journalist. He misses obvious clues and ignores the smoking gun of a related school scandal. The novel opens with Jacob's job anxieties, but even those fade into the background. And while another novelist might stress Jacob's Jewish-Chinese identity, Gordon only lightly touches it. His real interest is the millennial in crisis. Cut the strokes, is this it? And the ways Jacob glances backward. If every generation thinks it invented sex, Gordon's insight is that, thanks to technology, every generation does reinvent nostalgia. That's hinted at with the book's title, See Friendship. It's also the name of the Facebook tool for isolating the digital exchanges between oneself and a friend. It's a fitting metaphor. Facebook's feature delivers a seemingly complete record, but like all portraits, it's still partial. Jacob looks, he learns, but something will always elude him. As the novel progresses, the true source of Jacob's renewed obsession with Seth comes to light. Jacob has recently suffered a mental breakdown. He's now floating along, unmoored. Seth is part of a larger siren's call towards the past. Jacob hopes that by dwelling in memory, he might find a way out of his present. The self-sabotaging fixation on nostalgia reminded me of High Fidelity, Nick Hornby's Gen X cri de coeur. Hornby's narrator, Rob, looked to the past for evidence. Gordon proffers revisions and palimpsests. In searching for the answer, all I'd found were the limitations of my ability to understand, Jacob says. It isn't a spoiler to reveal that the novel resists traditional resolution. The podcast's success is ultimately a secondary concern. Jacob never rediscovers Seth in the way he initially set out to, and See Friendship rejects catharsis in favor of the diffuse grays of extended mourning. Jacob, per Dickinson, will go on aching still through centuries of nerve. The final chapter decenters Jacob in order to unfold outward, wonderfully so, like its own small metaphor of the internet. Gordon's smart novel on the warping effects of nostalgia and technology asks us to follow some Forsterian advice from a century ago. Only connect. The reviewer Ryan Chapman's most recent novel is The Audacity, which is now out on paperback. The Strange Case of Jane Oh by Karen Thompson Walker. The book cover has a photo of a young woman's face with shoulder-length hair looking at us. It is somewhat softened and faded with an overlay of pastel rainbow colors. The reviewer is Leah Greenblatt. She remembers everything except what happened to her yesterday. In Karen Thompson Walker's latest novel, The Strange Case of Jane Oh, a patient's unusual symptoms suggest metaphysical mysteries. There is a picture of a painting that depicts a therapist with his notes facing his patient, a young lady with her legs crossed, and the same lady also standing behind the therapist as possibly an observer. In the background, there is a forest and a green grassy area with someone lying supine. The man who mistook his wife for a hat. The girl so woefully abused that she developed more than a dozen distinct personalities. Psychiatrists' famous case studies can sound as fantastical as fiction, and they sometimes were, in fact, too outrageous to be true. The 38-year-old librarian at the center of Karen Thompson Walker's quiet, cool-tone new mystery, The Strange Case of Jane Oh, though, presents herself as almost pathologically normal, the walking embodiment of a saltine cracker, hold the salt. Pale, slim, and as carefully plain as her name, the soft-spoken Jane gives no reason for her visit when she arrives at the Manhattan office of an analyst named Henry Bird, and seems to regret it almost immediately. Less than 15 minutes after the session starts, she walks out. Cue the inevitable strange. 3 days later, Dr. Bird receives a call saying that a woman who matches Jane's description has been found unconscious in a field in Brooklyn's Prospect Park, without her wallet or phone or ID. The last thing she remembers is dropping her infant son off at daycare and walking the 4 blocks home to make a cup of tea 25 hours previously. That's all catnip to Dr. Bird, whose preoccupation with his new patient quickly exceeds professional bounds and only grows when she finally begins to talk. If not exactly textbook ethical, his interest is at least not adulterous. Jane is firmly and perhaps congenitally single, and baby Caleb is the product of a sperm donor. Bird himself is a widower with his own small daughter. The case file thickens when she confesses that her problem, generally, is too much memory. Her recall of past events, no matter how mundane, is photographic. She's like a data processor whose human software does not degrade. Then there's her account of what might have been the inciting incident to her park episode. A run-in on the street with an old acquaintance named Nico Lombardi, who she knows has been deceased for 20 years. That first reveal, Jane's remarkable recall, is a rare but real enough phenomena called hyperthymesia. The actress Mary Lou Henner of the 1970s sitcom Taxi is one of its best-known cases. The second, the inexplicable encounter, lands more in line with Walker's particular mode of storytelling, a style you might call soft sci-fi. The author's widely lauded 2012 debut, The Age of Miracles, imagined an Earth whose daily rotation abruptly slows, with a host of unsettling consequences. Her 2019 follow-up, The Dreamers, depicted the spread of a baffling, sometimes fatal sleeping sickness in a small college campus a year before the real-world arrival of the coronavirus. Both of those books were set in Walker's native Southern California and concerned themselves less with the mechanical details of their respective dystopias than with the intimate, small-scale dramas of their mostly young and female protagonists. Doesn't coming of age always feel like a bit of an Armageddon anyway? What they lacked in plot propulsion or writerly panache was made up for with a kind of gentle, unhurried, melancholy, a nimbus cloud of vibes. Many of the same themes flutter around the edges of The Strange Case of Jane Oh, particularly in the flashbacks to Jane's first meeting with Nico. Their tentative connection was the closest she came to making a friend in high school summer program in Manhattan 2 decades previously, and those scenes vibrate with the high-key hopes and anxieties of adolescence, the inherent loneliness of being a person in the world. Walker's world-building around the opaque adult Jane, though, is less assured. The pages here come larded with Wikipedia bits on psychiatry and semantics. Webster's dictionary lists two definitions for the word ache. And next to her heady Eucalyptus in California, the New York of the novel feels like a borrowed template, a dutiful screensaver in which the collective, boundless verve of city life is frequently noted, but rarely intrudes. And while Henry and Jane have every reason to be serious and even somber people, as protagonists, they are often, alas, wet blankets. "I've been told I can be tedious," Jane notes at one point, without apparent irony. Pizzazz is not a narrative prerequisite, but a little levity and specificity, a more colorful interior world, might have gone a long way toward deeper investment in the characters and their outcomes. As it is, the story, with its slow-churn revelations and a conclusion that tips towards the supernatural, builds an eerie, incomplete mood, a scrim of subdued intrigue obscuring stranger things. The reviewer, Leah Greenblatt, is an editor at The Times. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.